Radio Ghana.
A very good evening to you, and you're welcome to Behind the News. My name is Agatha Samoa, and tonight, government signals intention to tackle corruption head-on with the harmonization of corruption institutions of state to fight the canker. How would this ensure that corruption becomes a thing of the past? Ghana's placing on the Global Business Competitiveness Index by the World Economic Forum, source of worry to business advocates. What are we doing wrong? And why take your life when life should give you a thousand reasons to smile? Reported increase in suicide deaths takes center stage as the world observes Suicide Day. Join me in the next hour as we discuss these issues. You can also join the discussions by text 0266-677570. 0266-677570. Behind the News, live on Radio Ghana in Accra. We are also live on Unique FM 95.7 in Accra and Radio Central 92.5 in Cape Coast. Our text line again is 0266-677570. 0266-677570. Corruption has been a major setback to the development of the country. Attempts by successive governments to deal with the plundering of state resources by some politicians and government officials have not made any impact, as some believe the alleged looting continues. In fact, it is done with impunity and defy accountability. While some have attributed the situation to lack of proper commitment and political will of successive governments to addressing the problem, lack of coherent anti-corruption legislation has also been identified as the major cause. The Mahama administration this time wants to take the bull by the horn and deal comprehensively with corruption. Cabinet has consequently approved the Conduct of Public Officers Bill, a coherent and harmonized anti-corruption legislation aimed at providing legal backing to the Code of Conduct for all government appointees. How committed is the government to this initiative? Isn't it one of those political rhetorics? A Deputy Minister of Information and Media Relations, Phyllis Kwati Fusu, has joined us on the line to interrogate government's move to deal with corruption. Good evening, Phyllis, and welcome to the program.
Good evening, my sister, and good evening to my family.
Well, Phyllis, this bill seeks to provide a coherent and harmonize all other legislation on anti-corruption. Why the need for that, since we have not been able to utilize the existing legislation well?
Thank you very much for the opportunity. Now, this bill is important for a number of reasons. And the first one is that Chapter 24, specifically Article 284, makes provision for a code of conduct for public officers. Indeed, public officers are enjoined to conduct themselves in a manner that does not raise the issue of conflict of interest. Unfortunately, this appears only to be a code of conduct and does not come with any legal backing, which then makes it possible to punish officers or public officers who double in acts that could be deemed as corruption. Secondly, Ghana has ratified a number of important international anti-corruption conventions. Among them is the United Nations Convention on Preventing Corruption and the African Union Convention on Preventing and Combating Corruption. Now, these two international conventions ratified as far back as 2005. Unfortunately, they have not been incorporated into our laws, and therefore Ghana is not benefiting from the immense benefit that could be derived from implementing provisions of that convention. The Conduct of Public Officers Bill seeks to incorporate these aspects of this these conventions in it, and that will ensure that legal backing is given to what is internationally acknowledged as important ways of combating corruption. The third point I want to make is that many institutions, like SHRAD, for instance, have elaborate provisions on a code of conduct for public officers. SHRAD has taken pains to develop guidelines for public officials to avoid conflict of interest, for instance. Unfortunately, many of the provisions are not justiciable. In other words, they do not have legal backing. And so even when public officials are found to have engaged in conduct that one could describe as conflict of interest, there is want of legislation that could then make it possible for them to be, as it were, prosecuted or brought to book. There are also many other provisions in our laws that deal with corruption. Over the years, efforts have been made to enforce them, but because of their disparate and diverse nature, it makes it difficult to have one coherent policy or legislation on corruption that then makes it easy to go after people who act in ways that undermine the public trust. And that is the reason why government thought it necessary to put together this legislation. Unfortunately, it was approved by cabinet at this last meeting last week. It is expected that in the not too distant future, it will be put before parliament, and parliament will give meaning to it by passing it so that His Excellency the President can append the signature so it becomes law.
But you mentioned a code of conduct for public officers. To what extent has the government been able to apply the code to deal with corruption?
Well, the code of conduct covers a broad range of issues. It is not just about corruption. It also involves how public officers are to conduct themselves in a manner that preserves the public trust. For instance, there are strict guidelines on what kind of travels public officials can engage in and what processes exist for public officers or public officials to travel in order that we save the public trust from unnecessary exploitation. There are clear guidelines on how public officials have to deal with members of the public when it comes to discharging their responsibilities. They are enjoined to be fair, to be courteous, and to be diligent in their dealings with members of the public. But like I told you, all these are codes, if you like, ethics, which public officials are expected to abide by. But there is no legal provision that enforces compliance with those codes, and that is what this bill seeks to address. So it is not that government in the past has been unwilling to deal with persons who flout such provisions, except that legislation has been scanty in terms of enforcing those provisions. Now, it is envisaged that once this bill comes into effect, there will then be a reference point to which public officials can be held accountable.
Phyllis, some see this initiative as one of the political rhetorics, which is more of intention rather than action.
I would disagree with those who hold that since assuming office, President Mahama has demonstrated a commitment to fighting corruption. The first step he took was to draft a code of conduct, which was launched about 2 months ago when a retreat was held for deputy ministers. His Excellency the President himself took pains to come and launch. Then it was widely publicized and made available to all public officials so that they will be aware of it and conduct themselves accordingly. Now, it takes legislation to fight corruption. In the past, one could arbitrarily arrest people who are alleged to have engaged in corruption and deal with them in ways that do not necessarily respect due process. We have moved into a democratic era, and therefore it requires that we act according to the dictates of the law. What has been lacking is a sort of coherent legislation or law that makes it easy to go after people who engage in actions that may be deemed to be corrupt. It is also important to appreciate that existing legislation may not be far-reaching enough, because there are many other actions that could qualify as corruption that are not captured under our laws presently. And that is why SHRAD, for instance, has been doing a lot of work with regards to conflict of interest and regards to conduct that are not necessarily captured in our laws but are detrimental to the interest of the nation. This bill seeks to capture all those aspects of public life that is necessary to ensure that the public purse is spared actions that could deplete it by public officers. I must also emphasize that it is not only politicians and high-ranking government officials who can engage in acts of corruption. Sometimes public servants, civil servants who may not be on the radar or who escape the scrutiny of the media also are engaged in corruption. If you take a look at the various Auditor General's reports, you find that there are many ways in which crooked officials who are not high-profile personalities, who are not politicians, line their pockets with monies that otherwise belongs to the state. But they get away because the scrutiny often is on public officials who are holding very high positions in government or politicians who are holding an office or the other. This bill seeks to unearth all of that and ensure that everybody who is paid from the consolidated fund or who is paid through public funds is accountable, and everybody is made aware of the do's and don'ts of the office so that they may avoid the pitfalls that could lead them into acts of corruption. It is important to also point out that often the focus has been on fighting or punishing corruption. I think that this bill seeks to also prevent corruption, but it's an important way of ensuring that money that should go into development projects, for instance, will not end up in people's private pockets. Because public officials, before coming into public office, may have been engaged in one form of business or the other, and because our laws are a bit scanty or gray in terms of addressing their relationship with business partners who fall outside of their official duties, it is unclear exactly how one can get embroiled in conflict of interest. And we have had instances in the past where public officials have found themselves in conflict of interest situations because there was no clear-cut legislation, no clear laws that delineated the boundaries within which they can operate. This bill seeks to clarify all those issues, and I believe that anybody who gets to read the bill when it is put before Parliament, and I'm sure a healthy debate will ensue over it, would appreciate that a lot of work and thinking has gone into it, and it should go a long way to boost the fight against corruption.
And how soon are we going to see the passage of the bill or tabling it before Parliament?
Well, as I speak to you, work is almost complete on the bill. Cabinet has approved it. I'm sure final touches will be put in it, and it will be put before Parliament in the not too distant future. And I do not expect that it will take too long before Parliament approves it. I must also indicate that Parliament is a master of its own rules, but on the part of government, I've been done to ensure that as soon as possible it is put before Parliament.
Oh, Phyllis, hold the line for me. The Progressive People's Party has been protesting over the state of corruption in the country. What does the party make of the government's resolve to addressing the challenges of corruption comprehensively? Ani Alote Bruhammond is the chairman of PPP and is joining us on the line. Good evening, Mr. Bruhammond, and welcome to the program.
Well, good evening, and good evening to you, and good evening to the Honorable Deputy Minister and to your listeners.
Well, the government says it has initiated a bill to provide legal backing to code of conduct for all government appointees. I mean, a coherent and harmonized anti-corruption legislation. What is the PPP's position on this initiative?
Well, I believe that every effort must be encouraged, must be lauded. If the present administration has seen the need to put all of these conflicting legislations together to get a coherent law that will bind public officials, that's well and good. But how is that all going to happen? The Honorable Deputy Minister tells us that the Cabinet has approved it and will soon send it to Parliament for Parliament to discuss and give the final document. But who is going to vote for it in Parliament? The same Cabinet members who are MPs will be going down to Parliament to vote for it. That is where we believe that corruption is not going to go away per se if we have the same people constructing the bill in Cabinet and bringing it to Parliament to come and vote for it. There's no way they're going to dissent on the bill in Parliament. We believe that the Constitution we have, the 1992 Constitution we have in it inherent provisions that makes corruption institutionalized. We need to separate the executive from the legislature so that when a bill from the executive comes to the legislature, there will be a fruitful discussion and a good oversight over it so that if there are any flaws, they will point it out, send it back to Cabinet for review before it comes back. But as it stands now, the same Cabinet members are the ones coming into Parliament to vote on a bill that they have crafted in Cabinet. I don't see how they're going to vote against it. So we need to separate the legislature from the Cabinet. Point number two is that all of these things may be good and we need to encourage it. But at the end of the day, the Chapter 24 Code of Conduct for Public Officials also stresses that every member of Parliament must declare their assets before they take office. and declare their assets after they leave office. Are we doing that? When are we going to see those assets declared? And when they are declared, how are we going to know if we don't have the Freedom of Information Act to go after what has been filed? So corruption is not just putting four or five different bills together if we can't execute it. If we're going to execute it, we need to separate the Attorney General from the Minister of Justice so that as an independent prosecutor, they can then follow up on anyone that is going against the law. So as it stands now, as far as we are concerned, we believe that if we don't include the amendment to the 1992 Constitution, separating the executive from the legislature, we might not see the light at the end of the tunnel. We'll still have corruption going on and on and on.
Well, there is this school of thought also that we do not need another anti-corruption legislation. We need to resolve the anti-corruption organizations and should not interfere in their affairs. Do you belong to that school of thought?
Well, we would think that we have enough of those that would have allowed officials to uncover corruption. But as we say, because the Constitution itself lends itself to the Attorney General, who also doubles up as the Minister of Justice and serving at the pleasure of the executive, of the president, there is very little that the Attorney General is able to do, especially if the act is falling on one of its own members. We need to have an independent prosecutor, and if we do, I'm sure a lot of the existing laws that we are now harnessing them together into one code of conduct bill might be unnecessary.
So moving forward, how best can we tackle corruption head on?
Well, as the PPP has proposed, we have an opportune time to do so now with the Constitutional Review Implementation Committee. Our former President Atanos had the Constitutional Review Commission provide us with some guidelines. Soon, a draft bill from the CRIC will be presented to Cabinet and then to Parliament. We believe that this is the time for all Ghanaians to get involved in knowing what is being drafted in the Constitution so that we can offer our point of view so we can get a good Constitution that will allow the corruption that is going on now to be kept.
Mr. Abrahamson, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you so much for inviting me to your program.
Ni Alote Bruhammond is the chairman of PPP. Now, back to you, Phyllis. You heard Mr. Bruhammond there, but he talked about asset declaration, and the Constitution makes provision for the declaration of assets of government and state officials. Don't you think it's an area that, if adhered to, will enhance the fight against corruption in all spheres?
Yes, it is an important point that Mr. Bruhammond raised. The issue of asset declaration is one that government takes seriously. But as the law stands now on asset declaration, there are a number of flaws which makes its implementation a bit difficult. In fact, this Conduct of Public Officers Bill speaks to the issue of asset declaration and seeks to strengthen the existing legal regime regarding that particular matter. And that is why it is important that the public lends its support to this bill. The other issues that Mr. Bruhammond raised about the institutional reform regarding the Attorney General Department are matters that are ongoing. It's a long-standing debate. Some work has been done on it by the Constitutional Review Commission, as well as other matters bordering on our constitutional life. The issue of separation of powers is one that has also been thoroughly debated. But these are constitutional provisions which require tremendous effort to change. A national debate on whether or not it is appropriate for some members of parliament to be in the executive is one that one would welcome, but I would urge caution when tampering with some or tinkering with some of these constitutional provisions. I think that the system as it exists now has served us well. There's no reason why, for instance, someone who is part of the executive cannot voice out concern or dissent when some bill is brought to parliament that he strongly disagrees with. In the past, we have had people both on the majority and minority side raise issues about bills that have been brought in. We have a vibrant minority in parliament. We have an active civil society. We have a very vibrant media who will scrutinize those bills when it goes to parliament. I don't think that if the bill is not in the interest of the people of this country, it will pass. But I am confident, and indeed the government has put a lot of work into this bill and is confident that it will pass because of the quality of the provisions in the bill. But the government would also be willing to take on board any suggestions or additions or subtractions that members of parliament would make when the bill comes to be debated on the floor of parliament.
How about the argument that we need to resource and empower state anti-corruption institutions like Yoko and Sharadon, also encourage them to work independently rather than coming out with any anti-corruption legislation now?
Well, Yoko, which used to be the civil sort of office, has undergone tremendous transformation over the years. In 2010, a major transformation was carried out with Yoko, and they have been empowered to carry out extensive investigations into issues of corruption, issues of financial malfeasance, issues of financial crime, and what have you. The various security agencies, the police and other agencies continue to be resourced in order to boost their capacity to perform that critical role of punishing persons who are alleged to have engaged in acts of corruption. But all these notwithstanding, it is important that we get the legislation right. There are many, many things that are not captured under existing legislation which could pass for corruption, and that is what this legislation seeks to address. And as we grow as a nation, as we evolve our democratic process, our governance systems and all that, let us not opposed to new ideas that seek to enhance what we have been doing over the years. Because people speak about the need to fight corruption, but corruption must be fought in a very coherent and consistent manner. Wherever it is detected that there are shortfalls in terms of legislation or in terms of processes, it is important that we fill those gaps so that going forward we can all appreciate that indeed we do have a body of laws that makes corruption a high-risk activity. That is the objective of government, and we believe that that objective will be met when this bill is passed.
But one would ask, how committed is government to dealing with corruption?
Government is very committed. As and when instances of corruption have been brought to the notice of government, it has taken action. And I think that we all need to be involved in the fight. Often, we tend to focus a lot on political office holders and leave out those within the system who work within the lower ranks of government who engage in some of these. And I've indicated one source to you, the Auditor General's report. If you go through it, you'll find that perhaps the corruption that we speak about is not limited to public office holders. In fact, in many instances, no public office holders are actually mentioned in many reports. It is actually the ordinary staff, low-level staff in the ministries, departments, agencies who actually engage in these acts that undermine the nation's progress, because resources that should otherwise have been channeled into development end up in people's pockets. But often, because the light is not thrown on those people, we tend to lose the plot and always focus on the group of people who, for all you know, may not even be engaged in any act of corruption at all. So we need to broaden them, and we need to encourage the passage of more laws that toughen the stance against corruption and encourage government to come up with further laws, further legislation, and further steps that would broaden the fight against corruption.
Well, Felix, I'll indulge you to hold the line again for me. Also joining the discussions is Vitus Azimwizi, Executive Director, Ghana Integrity Initiative, an anti-corruption organization. Good evening, Mr. Azim, and welcome to the program.
Yeah, good evening, madam.
What is Ghana Integrity Initiative's position on government's initiative with regard to the conduct of public offices bill?
Well, it's a welcome development, because this bill that has been renamed was supposed to come before a previous cabinet, in the Public Office Holders Accountability Bill, and it never found its way to cabinet. And so if it has now gotten to cabinet and has had cabinet approval, we are very happy about it. We had looked at that predecessor bill and made some suggestions. We hope that some of those suggestions have been incorporated into this bill. And so, yeah, we welcome it, and we hope that it will get to Parliament, and not like the Right Information Bill and the others will get stuck in Parliament.
But some analysts believe we do not need any anti-corruption legislation. We should allow the existing ones to work.
Well, we have some anti-corruption laws, but there are some gaps that need to be filled. You know, the legal language is a bit difficult. Sometimes, the asset accreditation bill for example, the parliamentarians are saying that the law does not specifically say that the Auditor General should open the declarations and verify. But the Constitution says that the Auditor General should put in place measures to make it functional. And if the Auditor General thinks that the only way to make it operational is for him to open those envelopes and look at them to make sure that they are not blank papers put in there, what is wrong with that? So if there are, the government has come out with ways to plug these loopholes, to make sure that they are not subject to controversial interpretations, I think it is still welcome that we come out with these laws, to bring all these laws together. Especially there are also some laws that may conflict with each other or contradict each other. So if they bring them together, all those contradictions will be eliminated. And so we'll have maybe a better law that will help us in the fight against corruption.
But why have successive governments after independence not been able to deal with corruption as expected? What are we not doing right?
Well, part of it is the democracy in itself. People need money to contest and win elections and stay in power. And sometimes their genuine salaries and incomes may not be enough for them to be able to do that. And so sometimes people have to feel a bit, find their own illegal ways of getting money. And you can look at the last elections, it was very expensive. And so those are some of the problems. And then you go to people, rich people looking for funding, campaign funding. And then when later on you find out that those people have been involved in illegal things, you find it difficult to actually take action against them. So the political patronage is one of the issues. Then you can link that to lack of political commitment and will to address corruption. So, for example, when there are allegations, credible allegations, I talk about credible allegations of corruption, it's so difficult for the government to investigate. And even when there's a lot of pressure on government investigates, it takes so long for them to come out with sanctions. And so those are the main problems. One, the political patronage, the lack of political willpower. Then, of course, we have our cultural and tribal affiliations that sometimes put pressure on us to do wrong things and still think that, oh, it's okay. When you win, when you empower people, your relatives think that, oh, you must be making a lot of money and you need to bring the money to the house. And so these are some of the things that we have not been able to adequately address. We need radical governments that will say that, look, even though you funded me, you have committed a crime, you have to go, you have to face the rigors of the law. And we're not able to get that.
Is it not also right for the provision for the declaration of assets of government and some state officials in the constitution? Is it not appropriate to stick to that law?
Well, it is appropriate to stick to that law, but I'm told that the current law, the new bill that they are talking about, has absorbed it because probably because of those gaps that I've talked about. So if they have absorbed it, they need to also put into that law, and we made these suggestions to the Constitutional Review Commission to allow the Auditor General to verify those, the declarations. So we are just hoping that what has been brought into the new bill will take this into consideration so that you avoid all the controversies that people can give to whatever is already contained in the current law.
But have we allowed state anti-corruption organizations also like Shraj and Yoko to work as expected?
Well, I think to some extent we've allowed them to work, especially the Commission on Human Rights, that is a constitutionally mandated body that is independent of the executive. But sometimes, because of the way these people are appointed, the president is appointing the authority, so some of them may feel that, well, because the president has appointed me, he's done me a favor, and they may find it difficult to actually use the powers that they have. Secondly, politics is such that sometimes people may want to interfere, use their influences to try to say, please, this is our man, don't do this and this. So yes, they have the powers to do certain things, especially the Commission on Human Rights, but most of them do not have the prosecutorial powers. After their investigations, if it requires that there's need to prosecute somebody, they don't have those powers to go to court and prosecute the person. They have to go back to the Attorney General who will say, okay, I'm going to prosecute or I will not prosecute. Government is not interested in this case. So to that extent, they have not been adequately empowered to actually independently do their work.
So what are your expectations of this bill?
Well, I'm just hoping that they have absorbed some of the recommendations that we made to the Constitutional Review Commission and some of the recommendations that we made to the Public Office Holders Accountability Bill. They absorbed them into the final bill that will be brought before Parliament, and that Parliament would quickly enact it and the President would give his assent.
Because
that is done, it's left to the implementation.
We want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
You're welcome. Have a good evening.
Vitus Azim is Executive Director of Ghana Integrity Initiative, an anti-corruption organization. And back to you, Phyllis. Already is government to adopt some of the recommendations of Ghana Integrity Initiative and other stakeholders in dealing with corruption.
Now, if you could come again, I could hardly hear you.
I'm saying, how ready is government to adopt some of the recommendations of the Ghana Integrity Initiative and other stakeholders in tackling corruption?
Well, to the extent that the recommendations made by various civil society organizations are viable and would inure to the benefit of the nation and strengthen our anti-corruption legislation, government would welcome them and seek to incorporate them as much as possible in our laws. And indeed, we encourage the public to continue with the debate and make useful propositions and suggestions that could help enrich legislation that is aimed at fighting corruption. I think that if we went that line, we would be making progress as a nation. Because you see, corruption as it is not a fight that is to be left alone for government to handle. It involves our collective effort as a people, and we must all be on the lookout for persons who act in ways that border on corruption. That way, we'll be making progress as a nation, and we will overcome this canker.
Phyllis, many thanks for your time with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
Phyllis Kwachi Fosu is the Deputy Minister of Information and Media Relations. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Behind the News is live on Obonu FM 96.5 in Tema, Radio Central 92.5 in Cape Coast, and Sunrise FM 106.7 in Kofodia. Let's read some of your text messages. And Akati Raymond from Agotimekpatoi says, government is just throwing dust into the eyes of Ghanaians with this corruption bill because it has not been able to punish those indicted in the Jida report. Napoleon from Tumu Sankofa Bay says, the anti-corruption bill will reduce corruption in Ghana. Ghana should pass it quickly. And Big Bright says, right decision by government on corruption, but the ant cleans its house before staying guard over intruders. We pray corruption actually comes to an end. Many thanks for your text messages. Government says it is doing all it can to surmount the economic problems bedeviling the country. All parts of the country will therefore get a fair share of the national cake. And it looks as if Western region is getting the cake ahead of the other regions because government is at the moment striving to make it the economic hub of the country in a bid to create jobs, improve livelihoods and alleviate poverty. Unfortunately, it appears all is not well on the national front. The Global Business Competitiveness Index report released by the World Economic Forum shows Ghana dropping 11 places from 103 in 2012 to 114. The ranking is based on how favorable the environment for doing business is. Tonight on Behind the News, we explore the implication of the report on the economy and the country as a whole. And joining us on the line is Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry, Nilante Van Der Poel. Good evening, Ni, and welcome to the program. Hello. Good evening and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much and good evening to you.
Well, let's look at the Trade Ministry's decision to create an economic hub in the Western region. Why that decision to make Western region the economic hub of the nation?
Well, thank you very much, and that's a good evening to your listeners as well. Well, government's intention to make Western region a new trading hub is based on the fact that with the oil exploration, a lot of industries are relocating to the Western region. It is important that you make facilitation of trade much more easy.
Could you raise your voice? I mean, we can hardly hear you.
Well, I'm saying that with the oil find, the Western region has become the new destination for business. And as such, it's fully proper for government to make to create a necessary environment and a conducive environment for facilitation of trade in the region.
And how is this going to be done?
Well, immediately, government has started with creating the new free zones area in this Takoradi area, where we shall have a second free zones zone, where people will be ready to set up industries and to have opportunity of trading among themselves and create jobs and also create wealth for our people. Apart from that, we also set up, if you, your reporters will tell you, Enterprise Development Center, where small and medium enterprises in the region will have the necessary expertise and knowledge in order for them to be competitive in the provision of the local content in the oil industry and also other industries in the region. We're also looking at the possibility with the government's intention of rehabilitating the Western Railway Line. It is important for the free flow of goods and services. And also, you know that the Western region is also one of the entry points to our neighbors, Cote d'Ivoire. And I said it is important that we create a necessary environment to make trading, which is our intention to make trading in the sub-region more vibrant and more cohesive, because we believe that sub-regional and regional trade stands a better chance of increasing our foreign direct investment more than our export earnings from the current 5 million dollars to about $20 million, at which we have set ourselves as a target by 2015. So it is incumbent that we create a necessary atmosphere for all these policies and programs to go through.
Does it mean that all those who want to establish businesses will now have to turn to the Western region?
No, that's not what we are saying. But you need to diversify the environment. You can't concentrate all your eggs in one business when it comes to the issue of industrialization, when it comes to the issue of business. You can't put everything in one basket. Tema and Accra alone cannot continue to be the trading environment for our Ghanaian businesses, which should be able to expand the frontiers of business. Be able to leverage the ground so that people from the western part of the country, people from the other parts of the country who think that it's more convenient to do business in that area will also be. And don't forget that we have a port, one of the best ports in Takoradi. And as I said, it's better when you create the atmosphere there, that it makes it easier for people who want to open businesses, who want to do import and export from that corridor. It makes it easier for them.
Well, now let's look at other issues. Were you surprised at the report by the World Economic Forum which suggests Ghana dropped 11 places from the 2012 position of 103 to 104 as the most preferred environment for doing business?
Not really. Let me say that first, let me confess that I've not thoroughly digested the report. I've not had time to comprehensively read the report, look at the report in order to inform myself as to some of the factors that caused that drop. But the only thing that we ourselves have come to realize, and the president has, and president and the government has taken very serious view of, is the number of hours, number of days, number of weeks that people take to clear their goods from the port. And I said, between the Ministry of Transport and the Ministry of Trade and Industry and the Ministry of Finance, government is putting together a committee. Government has already put together a committee that is working out and trying as much as possible to facilitate and make sure that when your goods arrive at the port and the right documentation has been done, it shouldn't take you more than 5 hours to be able to clear your goods. We want to make sure we are one-stop shop of clearance at the port. That will make the clearance of goods and services at our ports of entry much more easier. The current situation where you have almost about 13 to 18 different points of checks at the port, it's not good for business. And as a government, as I recognize that, the government is doing everything possible to rectify the situation and make businesses at the entry port much more easier, more friendlier, and quicker. So that, to me, if that is one of the bases for which we dropped, I will not be surprised. And that's why government has preempted this report by taking necessary action to work out, to make sure these things are rectified. And two, once we've been able to look at the report extensively, I can assure you that the necessary advice would be given from the Ministry of Trade and Industry and the Ministry of Transport to government to see what government will have to do in order for us to maybe improve upon the position once again. And by the next time that we have the report, maybe things will have changed for the better.
You said you will look at the report closely, but has it a negative image about a country to the outside world? Looking at this report, does it cast a negative image about the country to the outside?
The summary I saw that I read, it's not all that gloomy. We were even credited, we were even commended for building strong institutions and other issues. So it is not. Let us not focus on only the negative aspect of it. Yes, we may have dropped in the ranking, but there were issues where Ghana was highly commended at building structures, building the necessary institutions that is holding the economy together, that is making businesses be more predictable. So those ones are also positive. And I wish that we rather look at those positive ones, look at the areas that we improve, and then to always focus on the negative things. Yes, we have dropped places. It's possible that within this 1 year that we are talking, within the period that they are talking about, it's possible that some other countries have done more when it comes to the issue of making trade, creating the necessary environment for trade and industry much easier. So we have had some focuses, and we may, within the period of assessment, as a people, as a government, be focusing on something else. So it's possible we may have gained, we have done, have improvement in other areas, but maybe not in this area you are talking about. But generally, even in this area, the report even commended Ghana on certain fronts. So let us not entirely say that this is a negative. No. Yes, it's good for us. We are going to improve upon it to make Ghana once more the best destination for doing business. This is an enviable position we are holding. And so if somebody has surpassed us, the only thing we can do is pick ourselves from where we have fallen and climb up again. That's the only thing we can do.
All right, Neil, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
Thank you very much.
Neil Ante Van Der Poel is the Deputy Minister of Trade and Industry. And Sydney Kesley Hayford is an economic analyst and is joining us on the line. Good evening, Mr. Kesley Hayford, and welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello. Welcome to the program, Mr. Kesley Hayford.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, is it a laudable move by government to make the Western region the economic hub of the country?
Well, any move to make somewhere in the country an economic hub is a laudable one. I don't think you can take it away from any government program that says they are going to try and improve the lives of people in the country. So if they have chosen the West region as the potential hub, I think it's a good idea.
And how feasible is this policy from your perspective?
Well, feasibility is a different one. The literacy levels in the Western region are very low. The student attendance of schools is very low. Education standards there are some of the lowest in the country. It's going to be a challenge to get human resource available to do what it requires to be done. I am not sure exactly what it is that brought up the selection, and whether if it's because that there's a potential gas pipeline that is going to help to develop some of the industry there, then yes, but the potential and the growth potential for that part of the country is rather limited. We have cited most of our industries there in the past. The rubber industry used to be there. The lumber industry used to be there. Cocoa is very, very prevalent in the community. But the added value that we require in order to turn something into an economic hub is a challenge. And I don't know exactly what government means when it says it is going to turn it into an economic hub, which means that it will become a center for economic activity. The definition is still very unclear, and I would like them to have said much, much clearer exactly what it is that they will do that will convert that region into an economic hub. So I'm quite uncertain. I think I've heard too many of these platitudes before, so I take it with a huge pinch of salt, and I'm not sure whether there's any particular program that is going to be put in place to make the Western region any better than the rest of the country.
But then, if you were to give an advice to government, what should government do to make the plan achievable?
My advice is we need added value to our raw material. And that's the most critical thing. We need energy supply in abundance across that part of the country. If the GWE dam is specifically allocated to that arena, so we have a lot more consistent power supply. Generally, industrialists will cite their programs there. That should create employment and it should boost. But the government should only create the infrastructure and create the environment for it to work, and then back out of it and let private sector initiative and let market forces drive the growth in the sector. All too often, government wants to too much be in the middle of everything. And whenever it does, that's where we fail. Our politicians have to learn to just create the environment and then let it work. And we're too interested in keeping our arms wrapped around the program. And in the end, we stifle the program and it never takes off.
So if we succeed in making Western region the economic hub, do you foresee businesses complying with this national policy, or you foresee some resistance from businesses?
The line is very breaking up very bad, and I can hardly hear you.
I was saying that if government succeeds in making Western region the economic hub of the country in a bid to creating more jobs, improving livelihoods, do you foresee businesses complying with this national policy, or you foresee some resistance from businesses?
So you see, businesses will always move where they can make money, where they can create revenues and make. So if region becomes a center where business can actually, you know, step up industrial and be giving some kind of incentive to kickstart, they will always go there. It's one thing that we have not really understood in Africa, that you have to just let people do what they like to do, because by nature, the human being is a capitalist. And we're forcing socialist paradigms onto a capitalist innate system, and that never works. But if government is able to succeed and create the right environment, private sector will move in. It won't even need us to come. It will automatically go there because the incentives will be right, and the opportunities will be available, and they'll be able to create money for the investors and shareholders. It always works that way. And we're trying to buck it all the time is what creates the constrictions in our economies and makes things difficult for us.
Now, let's digress a bit to Ghana dropping 11 places from 103 to 114 on the World Economic Forum Competitiveness Index for doing business. What might have caused this?
Well, you know, yeah, the typical things that have always been there are still there. If you look at the most problematic factors that were identified for us and we pulled it down, they are very, very clear. Access to financing was one. Corruption was the second one. Tax rates being the third one. And poor work ethic in national labor forces was the next one. And then the inadequate supply of infrastructure. These are the key things where we lost out. These are the things that pulled us down in the rating. I think I caught the tip end of this negative underpoise delivery, that we are constantly focusing on the negative, and there were some positive things. Warranted, there were some positive things. But the thing is, the very things keep dragging us down all the time are not improving. And that is where we need to focus our attention. We are still struggling with high interest rates in the country. We are borrowing money at between 30 and 35% per annum from our universal banks. It's too high. The microfinance and savings and loans companies are offering money at 3% to 4% a month. That rolls out to be about 36% to 48% a year. This is way too high. Access to it is also impossible, especially for the underprivileged in society who do not have bank accounts and who are struggling to find some place in the economic environment. The next thing that we were slighted for is corruption. Corruption has always been a challenge. It has been there. We have talked about corruption in our system for so long. It is still one of the issues, one of the items that draws us down. And our tax rates are too high. enough. And work ethic is also very, very poor. Nobody needs to tell you. You go into any public office, any public sector or civil service sector in this country, and all you see is people sitting down, generally not doing any work, and the productivity is low, and they frustrate you until you have to bribe them in order to be able to get your task completed. These are the things that we were cited for. And I don't think there's any excuse for saying that we're harping on the negative. All I am saying is, if these are consistently at the top of our list, it's time that we move them off the top of the list and something else should become a problem, if so. But not the same things recurring year after year, but decade after decade. It's way too much. It's beyond sustenance now.
Briefly, can we regain our position in the not-too-distant future?
Yes, you can. I mean, you take a thing like corruption. You see, it is not so much as being corrupt, but it's being perceived to be corrupt. If the government will step up to the plate and do the right thing and eliminate those corruption perceptions, the rankings will change very quickly. Access to financing is a simple one to fix. It needs the Bank of Ghana and the Ministry of Finance to determine how to cap the interest rate spread so that we don't continue to borrow money at such high rates.
All right.
Those are two things that can be done very easily. They are not complicated. And tax rates are a matter of budgetary policy. Budgetary policy is a matter of revenue and expenditure control. That can be fixed. They are not impossibility.
We want to thank you for your time with us tonight. Sydney Kesley Hayford is an economic analyst. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Let's read some of your text messages. And Kojo Ekins from Cape Coast says, Power Kwesi Ndum and his PPP should mount the campaign platform to kickstart their political campaigning instead of demonstrating. AU Farouk writes, AFAC should give us a break. They have no moral right to call for the head of the EC boards. Tete from Nyankuma Sahinko says government should re-nominate the DCEs and MCEs because it is delaying. General from Yendi says we are disappointed in Anado for the late exhibition of this good character on the verdict. He should have shown this in 2012 and win our votes instead of the all die be die. And Esedu Nicholas from University College of Education says committing suicide in our societies is rampant due to lack of public education. And Gershon Ezamilat Kaswa says, please, I want to know from the staff of Volta Star Radio why the program LFCLEGBE is no longer active on the station. Well, I hope they are listening, Gershon. And Lazarus Delwinawafu from Gary says, the move to combat corruption is a laudable idea, but how authentic and realistic will it be? And S.B. Ben Tumpo says, if nothing touches the branch of the palm tree, it would not rattle. Government decision to take off the teacher training allowances is unfair. It's Behind the News live on Radio Ghana. Do you know every 40 seconds a person dies through suicide? Startling, isn't it? This is a fact put out by the International Association for Suicide Prevention. From the report, nearly 1 million people worldwide die by suicide each year, a figure estimated to exceed the number of deaths by homicide and war combined. As the world marks World Suicide Day today with the theme Stigma, a Major Barrier for Suicide Prevention, we ask why suicide should be an option for death for some people, and we hit the lines to speak to Professor J.B. Asari, lecturer at UDS and former Chief Psychiatrist, Ghana Health Service. Good evening, Prof, and welcome to the program.
Good evening. Thank you very much.
Well, Prof, why should one choose suicide as an option for death?
Yes, you see, some people are vulnerable. Vulnerable in the sense that they are unable to tolerate hardships and losses. Losses of all kinds. And they go into depression. This current world is full of strife and people want to achieve. And there is a lot of competition. And those who are unable to meet the demands of life may want to take their lives away themselves. And this all because of loss of self-esteem, what other people would say about them or value them and so forth. But usually, they will take away their lives because they feel that the end has come, that there's no other way. They don't see any light ahead of the tunnel.
Well, looking at this, yes, seem stigma a major barrier for suicide prevention. How on earth would one take his life on the basis of stigmatization?
You see, that comes again with the vulnerability. Some people inherit that vulnerability not to be able to stand stresses of all kinds. Stigma. Once you are stigmatized because of a deformity, because of mental illness or exclusion from society, then what comes into your mind is a sense of worthlessness. You are useless. And therefore, you feel that nobody needs you and you don't see the reason why you should live. You see, stigma is something that really is very painful. And if you don't have somebody close to you who can support you and help you to overcome all these difficulties, then you are likely to think that nobody needs you and therefore you must leave the world.
Well, recent reports of an administrator at Konfanochi Teaching Hospital committing suicide out of a text from her husband threatening to divorce her. Are there precursors for suicide that close to us?
Yes. You see, again, it's going to be a loss. You consider all the help or whatever you're going to, all the help that you get from your relationship and what you're going to lose if that person goes away from you, divorces you. Then you become so unhappy, so depressed, and the likelihood of you committing suicide if you don't have good supporting systems is there, you see. So there was also a student, another student, who I heard couldn't have eight A's or something like that, you see. It's all because of the competitiveness of this world and also feeling that he has not achieved, and people may feel that he wasn't up to it, you see. And this person, it's likely that may have inherited this vulnerability to be depressed and having difficulties in coping with stress.
Well, perhaps so briefly, how do we avoid suicide?
Yes, you can avoid suicide when you have good relationship where you can let people know your problems. If there's something wrong, if there's something happening that you don't like, if you feel down, you feel unhappy, you are not sleeping well, you feel depressed, you need to talk to somebody about it. And you need to get help. Usually people who commit suicide may give some kind of signs or warning that they're going to die, except that people close to them don't actually pick those signals. Either they write something down, or they will tell you they are traveling, or they may simply tell you that life is not worth living, I wish I was dead. And anybody who tells you, I wish I was dead, should be taken seriously, and you should ask or ask for help for that person if you cannot do it.
All right, Prof, we want to thank you for your time with us tonight.
You're welcome.
Professor J.B. Asari is lecturer at UDS and former chief psychiatrist, Ghana Health Service. Let's read some of your text messages. And Monica Cons in Avungo says, today is World Suicide Day. We pray for God's intervention for those contemplating suicide. And Encho Jacob from Kologu says, I don't understand why the police these days do not want people to exercise their constitutional right by going on demonstration to register their grievance. When PPP wanted to go on demonstration during the election petition, they said because of security reasons they should not. Now the election petition is over. Why are the police finding excuses again? And this is where we wrap up for tonight's edition of the program. George Kwaku controlled the sound. George, welcome back from your leave. And my producers were Edmund Tete, Phyllis Kofi, John Pobi, Christopher Sedu, and Celestine Avi. Babo to read the summaries, and my name is Agatha Samwa. Many thanks for staying tuned.